From the newsroom of PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. A health association in Kiribati is successfully helping to change negative attitudes towards sexual health and rights and the use of contraceptives. Representatives from the Kiribati Family Health Association, or KFHA, recently spoke at the Sexual and Reproductive Health and Rights Conference that was held in Wellington, New Zealand, on the challenges they've faced in raising awareness and educating families in their communities. Indira Stewart has more.
10 years ago, sexually transmitted infections were a critical health issue in Kiribati. A World Health Organization survey in 2006 showed increasing incidence of both STIs and HIV in the country, with chlamydia being endemic among both pregnant women and seafarers. It also showed increasing rates of teenage pregnancy. Thamoa Moanata says people in Kiribati are generally not aware of their sexual health and rights, but the association has been working hard to change that.
We have done an awareness programs with the communities. We have carried out the consultations with the traditional leaders, counselors, heads of household, a group of women and young people.
Ms. Moanata says religious beliefs have led to more modern forms of contraception being considered sinful among locals. She says the Billings ovulation method, which helps women monitor their fertility by using colourful beads that track their menstrual cycle, is the only method accepted by the Catholic Church, to which most Kiribati belong to.
The Catholic women also the men, they found it very easy to use it because, you know, in this psychopedia, it has different colours and they know colours that they will fertilise eggs.
Abitare Tekeke says the association has pushed towards engaging more men in their programs to help improve access to family planning.
Men are the boss in the family and they are the one that take control. So right now we are trying to target them and try to get them to really know what really, especially the benefits, what are the benefits that they will get out from this sexual reproductive health and right, and to allow women, at least they give them a room to discuss and what best that we believe in the family planning, that women's roles are very important in the family.
Mr. Tekeke says the only way they've been able to implement programs on sexual and reproductive health and rights in rural areas is by approaching village chiefs and using a holistic program that addresses health and well-being.
We developed an SP that covered everything, every aspect of their life, like not only health, but also development, peace, and also to preserve the environment. And then we integrate health as part of it. And in that way, they accepted it, and they see that, it's a very important.
Mr. Tekeke says the success of convincing rural chiefs allowed them to implement their programs into the wider communities.
So we approach from the top, from the leaders. Then when we get the permission, we go to the men, who is the head of household. After that, we go to the women, and the last with the youth groups.
Mr. Tekeke says winning over the men is key.
Men are listening to men. We have a role that's very important for our, not only for our family, but for the nation. Because it's all about our choice. Because you are the first one to give authority and to authorize everything that you think the best for you and for your country.
With the Health Ministry's support, GIFA has further trained another 20 community educators who are continuing to build networks and mobilising the strategic plans that are being implemented in communities. This is Indira Stewart.
The Cook Islands and Maria Moana plan to manage the country's entire marine environment very closely and is being put into operation. Mariamona Marine Park will allow commercial activity while at the same time considering conservation and environmental values. One of the people behind the project from the start is Kevin Iro. He told Don Wiseman that Mariamona, which is initially referred to the Southern Cook Islands, has gotten a whole lot bigger.
So Mariamona is going to cover the whole of the Cook Islands EEZ, so it's about 2 million square kilometres.
And that makes it the biggest marine reserve in the world, is it?
Well, we're really not looking at it as a marine reserve as such, and more a marine managed area. So what the government and our traditional leaders and a lot of the people involved in conservation, we just basically want to change the mindset of how we approach or how we look at our own ocean space or our own ocean domain. And, you know, it's a paradigm shift in how we're going to look at our ocean. So basically we're going to call our whole EEZ or our whole ocean domain Marae Moana, which loosely translates as sacred ocean, and basically then ask our commercial or industrial partners to carve out areas that they want to operate in. And instead of saying, you know, oh, where are your protected areas or where are your areas of conservation, we change that all around and say, no, it's all sacred, it's all protected. People should be asking now, you know, where are your areas of fishing, where are your areas for, say, deep sea mining, for instance, you know. So it's a whole different way to look at the ocean, and we believe it's, you know, the indigenous way to look at the ocean. So our forefathers, we believe, considered, you know, the ocean as sacred, and we want to bring that back, you know, make the ocean sacred again and educate our children and our people, re-educate them, basically.
Within all of this, there is going to be very significant exploitation, isn't there, in terms of, for instance, this big new fishing deal with the European Union?
Absolutely, and I mean, that's what you've got to understand, that our forefathers considered the ocean sacred because it also was a provider. So we're not saying that what we're doing is going to completely shut off all development or stop us from getting resources, but it'll be done in such a way that it's more managed and it's more transparent, and, you know, the whole nation should know where these activities are going to take place and where they can't take place, more importantly.
All right, so it's been on the table now for, I think, about 3 years. You've still got to get legislation through Parliament, don't you?
Yeah, so draft legislation has been completed, and now we're just waiting on our Crown Law Agency to oversight that, and then obviously it'll go to Cabinet for approval. But it's very close, and yeah, it has taken a long time purely because we've consulted with all our people. We've, you know, had to go right up to the north, and very hard to get to some of our islands, but we've consulted with all our people and all our communities, and now we're ready to make a start. And like our forefathers who put in conservation measures or ra'ui, you know, these are shifting or dynamic areas as well. So it's not to say things are set in stone, but we do have to start somewhere. And we believe that we've come up with a good balance for industry and for the commercial fishery. But we also believe that we're putting in a whole lot more protection than we normally would have started with, you know, on I'd say, a Western conservation measures.
In terms of the legislation, under which ministry are you going to fall? Is it going to be under Marine Resources?
No, actually, under the new legislation, Marae Moana will have their own agency within the Office of the Prime Minister. It's not going to be a big agency because it's really going to have a role just to work with other agencies and coordinate all the other agencies that, you know, come under the Marae Moana policies.
All right. There's going to be, given this vast area, 2 million square kilometres, it's going to require a fair degree of vigilance, isn't it? What are you going to do? How are you going to do that?
Well, surveillance is always going to be a big issue, especially when you're talking large expanses of ocean that we have in our region. But as the years go by and technology gets better and satellite technology gets better and we're able to track just about every boat coming through our waters that carry tracking systems, and it's much easier for us to actually track the boats that are licensed to us, obviously. But there's technology out there. They're testing drone technology and obviously satellite technology in other parts of the region that are working quite well. So it's just a matter of, like I said, starting from point A and then working from there instead of waiting for the technology to come along.
Costly, though. So where are you going to get the money? Is it coming from donors? Where's it coming from?
Well, we're hoping. We've been working the last 5 to 6 years with Conservation International. We've partnered with Oceans 5, who've been big contributors to Marae Moana for the last few years also, IUCN. And so we're hoping to continue, and obviously there are partners that are waiting for legislation to pass so that they can assist us on the back end of implementation of Marae Moana. And so it's quite exciting that, you know, there's a lot of interest shown in what we're doing because it's quite unique in what we're doing, and there's not many countries in the Pacific that are doing what we're doing and have a vision that we've got. With, you know, we're trying to bring back that sacredness of the ocean and how we as Pacific Islanders see the ocean and see things from our perspective. And there are countries like Palau and New Caledonia that are doing significant conservation measures within their own EEZ. Kiribati is another one. So we're not alone out there, but yeah, it's going to be one of those things where as we develop things and other nations see that these are working, that, you know, hopefully encourage other Pacific nations to follow suit.
Amnesty International says there's positive signs that Fiji may be taking steps to end a culture of torture and brutality in the security forces. The organization released a report into several cases of torture and how justice is often delayed or denied to coincide with the 10th anniversary of Frank Bainimarama's military takeover. Amnesty International Pacific researcher Kate Schultz says people are still being violently assaulted by security forces that act with relative impunity. But she told Jamie Tahanaha that there have been some positive signs of progress, although there is still a long way to go.
What we found was that there are a range of issues which entrench impunity. I mean, some of these cases are coming to light and they're not being investigated or not being investigated with due diligence. So what we've seen in the YouTube video which emerged in relation to Iowani Benedito, who was beaten in 2012, it took nearly 2 years before they opened up a proper investigation and started to charge officers involved in that incident. We've also got constitutional immunities, which now say that government officers can't be held accountable. So people who might have been tortured as little as 2 years ago don't have access to justice in those cases. You know, so we have seen this happen from time to time. And one of the significant problems that we think is important to talk about around the 10-year anniversary of the coup is, you know, the role of the military in civilian policing. And I think it's important on the 10-year anniversary that we start to talk about, you know, what more can be done on these cases to move things forward in Fiji, to ensure better accountability when it does arise, and to make sure that the security forces are actually complying with their own laws.
In the case of Benedito, as you point out, it took 2 years for an investigation to start. There's many other cases where we're not sure there has been an investigation at all, or it just kind of disappears after a while. Why is that?
I mean, so what we're seeing is that there's been a number of high-profile cases in the last few years, and raising the profile of these cases in some instances has led to limited accountability for those cases. In Fiji, the systems and processes aren't set up well enough in law, policy and practice to stop these instances occurring. We have seen some positive signs and we've spoken to government about this. They are talking about, you know, a first hour procedure for persons in custody, making sure they have access to lawyers and family members the moment that they're taken into custody. And what we're saying here is that there's much more that needs to be done. But when it does occur, we also need transparency, you know, accountability for these cases, as unfortunately is the exception rather than the rule. And what we want to see is that turned on its head.
These are the cases we know about, though. I mean, the report suggests, and of course reports we've had suggest, there are many more going on where nothing happens at all.
Yes, I mean, what we see around the world is that the number of people that feel comfortable reporting cases of torture and ill treatment, the ones that are willing to come forward, are significantly lower than the cases that are out there. We are only referring to the high-profile cases where they're felt comfortable making a complaint either to the courts, through the justice system, to the police, or to the media. You know, so the reality is that these cases are probably only the tip of the iceberg. So what we need to see is an improvement in the police complaints process so that people know how they can actually make a complaint. You know, when those systems are lacking and not there, people are less likely to feel comfortable reporting these matters to the police. You know, we've also seen in this case in Lautoka that a person who made a complaint against torture has been harassed and threatened in his home since he made that complaint. And, you know, that kind of behaviour is very concerning and it's absolutely unacceptable.
So does this suggest that there needs to be some kind of independent body that has some kind of power to investigate?
Yeah, so I mean, essentially we don't take a view on what that mechanism should be, but international law does define what are the characteristics of an independent investigation process. So in some states we see that there is a crimes and misconduct commission, or there might be a police ombudsman. You know, Fiji does have a human rights institution, so there is potential scope to either establish outside the police force reviewing these cases, or to build up the Fiji Anti-Discrimination and Human Rights Commission and give them the powers to do those things.
Recently, in the past year or so, we've seen both Frank Bainimarama and Sitiveni Ngilio both admit to an extent that there is a problem with violence and torture. The Human Rights Convention has been ratified and such. Is there any sign of action following these pledges?
Yeah, I mean, essentially we saw, doing this report now was because we see an opportunity in this shift in government attitudes. You know, we have moved a long way from a couple of years ago, Bainimarama saying, I stand by my men, to a few weeks ago at this torture convention saying, look, there is a problem within our security forces of resorting to violence and we do need to change that. We are providing a roadmap essentially for government to try and address some of these issues. If it is committed to addressing torture and ill treatment, they will take on board some of our recommendations and we always remain willing and open to engage with them and discuss how they can meet those international standards.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. A tourist attraction in Fiji denies it is discriminating against locals by giving priority to tourists at peak times. Local people are not allowed to use the pools at the Kolawisava Forest Park when cruise ship passengers are visiting. Park's forestry officer, Lagosagara Tuga, talked to Joe O'Brien about the policy.
For the tourist system, when there's a vessel in port in Suva, we'll give them 1 to 2 hours, and then after that we open back, we'll open it back to the locals. We're just giving the pools to the tourists first, the priority then, because when they're on the ship coming to Suva, this park has been advertised on board, I understand, and we just like to keep it that way and make that connection and let them have a good time and relax when they come into the park.
How often is that happening then? How often do you get the people from the ships at the park?
2-3 times a month.
Is this just a new policy you've introduced?
No, it has been there. We thought of just upgrading it just to cater for the amount of people that goes into the park. We have thousands of people going to the park per month.
How many people from the ships do you get when they come?
For a trip, we're looking at 600 tourists.
So they're all coming at once?
Yes.
So why have you made this policy to restrict access for locals when the tourists are there?
Well, as I said, we don't have a huge pool, just small, but with nice waterfalls. Tourists like to take a dip, and they would appreciate the clear, cool, blue waters. And when the locals come in, you know, it's just simply overcrowded.
Is it also because, have there been incidents with tourists being robbed? Or,
no, not being robbed, just being some items go missing, Joanne.
Have there been many incidents like that?
No, we just had one-off incident, and then we're trying to address it now,
I understand there has been some criticism that this is discriminating against local people. What's your response to that?
No, it's just simply a misunderstanding by local people, because most of the local people, they listen to us and they understand and they can wait just for 1 or 2 hours just to let the tourists enjoy the pool, and then the tourist pulls out again, they leave the pool, and then they enjoy the pool for the whole day. Because at the end of the day, it's the safety and security of tourists that's paramount, that has to be kept intact.
And the park, is it quite a major tourist attraction for people to come visit?
Yes, definitely. We have a series of waterfalls, we have a series of pools. Recently, after Tropical Cyclone Winston, it has somehow diminished because of what has happened in the park.
How badly was it affected?
Not that bad. It's just falling trees that fell into the pools, and we were just trying to clear it out. Just minimize pool spaces that we used to have before.
So is that why your pool space is reduced? Is that being one of the reasons for this role?
Yes.
So once the pools are cleared of those trees, will you be able to open up access for the locals then, or do you think
this
role will stay?
Definitely, yes.
So is it just a temporary measure while you're doing that work?
Yes, we are undergoing a major upgrading project for the pool at the moment. And hopefully come January, we'll be able to open it 24/7 to both tourists and the locals.
The man coordinating preparations in Bougainville for a vote on possible independence says they are making good progress. James Tanis, a former president, is the secretary of the Department of Referendum, Veteran Affairs and Peace. The vote on possible independence from Papua New Guinea is due to be held in June 2019, and the department's role is to make sure people are ready. Bougainville also has satisfied certain criteria, such as being good governance and signs that illegal weapons have been removed from the community. Mr. Tanis told Don Wiseman about the nature of the work they are doing.
To meet the requirements of the Bougainville Peace Agreement and the constitutional arrangement, the two governments agreed on a joint work plan that includes weapons disposal, reconciliations, good governance assessments, and ongoing consultations, giving special recognition to participation of women in the referendum preparations. And of course, consultations between the two governments, awareness, and the post-referendum transition processes.
In terms of weapons disposal, this is a vexed question, isn't it? Because there were those long periods 10 or 12 years ago of trying to rid Bougainville of weapons, but there's still lots out there. So what sort of progress are you making there?
Let me start by saying is that there's good progress on the process to establish independent agency that will conduct the referendum. The two governments have agreed on the documents to establish it. While that is taking place, on the Bougainville side, we have given our commitment to the national government that we will pursue weapons disposal as a Bougainville obligation to meet its part of the bargain under the peace agreement. And so as part of its obligation for welfare and good and welfare of the people of Bougainville. So the region is now going through a process of establishing referendum committees in all the 33 or the 39 constituencies of Bougainville. So we have completed South Bougainville. We have completed Central Bougainville. This week we have started North Bougainville. So what it means is that through the constituency-based committees, the issue of awareness on referendum, the issue of weapons disposal, the issue of unification, and the issue of a political dialogue for the people to talk about their future is now taken back into the communities. And there's a reason for it. If you look at the start of the conflict, this is a conflict that started from the villages, the communities taking up arms against the state. And for us to end the war properly, and for us to make sure there is guarantee that this referendum is all-inclusive and the outcome is a greater chance of being accepted whichever way it falls, we are engaged in a process of making sure we take the referendum preparations back to the communities. For example, on weapons disposal, this is an important move because when weapons disposal was implemented 10 years ago, there were factional groups, DRA, resistance, and now they are no longer there. What we have, at times have changed, the weapons have moved from those factional groups into the community. So to make sure we are effective, we have come up with a strategy of organizing and mobilizing the communities.
But there are isolated groups around. There are parts of Mekamui, for instance, who remain opposed.
Yes, we are playing a very careful priority on it. We have, in fact, in my department, the referendum department, we have recruited a Mekamui referendum officer. And also, prior to that, we successfully negotiated a memorandum of agreement between the ABG and the Mekamui faction in Panguna to make Panguna weapons free by 31st December 2018. And this deadline is actually very significant because the Mekamui gave this undertaking to make sure they complete weapons disposal on their part 6 months ahead of the target date.
If the referendum is going to happen in June of 2019, there's clearly going to have to be a decision made quite some time before that as to whether or not the region is ready, whether it's satisfied all of these conditions.
That is the idea. So yeah, that's why we have this target date by the Mekamui for 31st December 2018. And in fact, last week, the Central Bougainville Regional Committee set their target date to end all the preparations in Central Bougainville to December 31st, 2017.
Is that going to be achievable, given, I suppose, that the province has had now 11 years of autonomy and it's still having significant issues? Can it make a significant stride in the next 12 months?
It depends on how we look at the definitions of good governance and weapons disposal. In my view, the two governments really need to focus on the ability of the institutions. For example, Bougainville has delivered successfully on a number of elections, the national elections and Bougainville elections. So in terms of the democratic institutions of conducting elections, I think Bougainville has the capacity to display that it can attest to some level of good governance. And of course, we have the administrations and the departments. So it will, I think, come down to a level of compromise between the two governments, because it will be unrealistic
for a two governments to expect and try to rate Bougainville in terms of good governance to a normal peacetime situation. From what I've seen on the ground is that the people actually are in arms. This is the moment they've been waiting for, and already in central Bougainville, as I said, they've made an undertaking that they will declare central Bougainville referendum ready by 31st December 2017. And in fact, North Bougainville did their declaration yesterday. They are committed to announcing North Bougainville referendum ready by second quarter of 2017. It's now like the old days in which people took the responsibility to end the war. They did not wait for a government. I think that's a similar situation now that is developing on Bougainville, especially after the two governments have announced a target date and put out a referendum work plan.
And before we sign off, I just want to inform you that the programs of Focus Asia Pacific, the one you're listening to now for our partner stations, for the dates of January the 27th and February the 3rd, will be two specially pre-recorded editions. Chinese New Year's falls from the 26th of January until February the 6th, so only a skeleton news crew will be working in those days. Those who listen to the three times daily edition, which is broadcast on shortwave to the Pacific, will hear the program as normal. The effective change is only for those 2 weeks and is only for those who listen to our partner stations. But we will have some special programs during that time, so we hope that you can tune in. If you want to get in touch with us to let us know what you think of the program, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. Once again, focus@pcjmedia.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Perrault, wishing you well. Say so long and take care.